All right. So, like I just mentioned, I think we're going to talk a bit about your postdoc time at Irvine, working with Sherry Rowland. You mentioned that he was focused on hot atom chemistry.
Right.
You know, chemical properties of atoms with excess translational energy. When you went to Irvine, from what I understand, you received kind of a list of different things
right.
that you could work on while there.
Right.
And the CFC project was the one that was most intriguing.
Right. It was quite unusual in that... Ay, le encargo una cosa. Creo que se me olvidaron mis otros anteojos en... Los debo de haber puesto en mi oficina, a ver si nada más me los paso. Okay.
I'm yeah. I just thought you guys were hungry.
Well,
I'm going to take it. Thank you. Gracias.
Okay. Thanks. I think I'll pass now, but feel free to, as we say in our PICAS meetings, it's quite acceptable to eat and speak at the same time, provided it's not the same person.
Unfortunately, someone else has to transcribe it, so go ahead, it won't be our problem.
Okay. Yes, what was unusual is that Sherry Rowland had this, normally it's reasonable, you have for a postdoc as opposed to a graduate student, perhaps, where it's more likely that you assign him to a project, although it might be flexible. As a postdoc, you sometimes have different options, sometimes you don't. But Sherry became interested in this issue that he had learned about in one meeting, as you know. I don't know if you have that background, but I can summarize it to you anyhow. I guess the American Meteorological Society or the American Chemical Society, I don't remember which organizations, but they very wisely decided, hey, we can, let's have some meetings where we have scientists from these two very different disciplines, see if what can come out of that. But very much oriented as meteorologists were at that time, just using chemicals as tracers, okay? Yeah. So the chemists in some sense were playing a secondary role there. If you can analyze and find something in the atmosphere, then you can help the meteorologist learn about how things move. I didn't quite know that that came, I realized that later. But one of those set of chemicals, Jim Lovelock had just invented this electron capture gas chromatograph, and he was able to measure the CFCs, industrial compounds, not of natural origin, although at that time there was some question whether perhaps small amounts were coming out of volcanoes, and it turns out that was really not the case, or if at all they were extremely minute amounts. So these were, that's a unique situation, industrial chemicals in the atmosphere, but the CFCs had a lot of affinities, if you want, with the types of molecules that both myself with George Pimentel and Sherry Rowland were using, not because they were important by themselves, but because they offered unique opportunities to learn about fundamental chemistry. One of the hot atoms is fluorine, okay, so CFCs, and I had studied the chemical acids produced by some similar molecules that had halogens. Just to remind you, if you want, that was just dawned on me, but it's not that far-fetched. Chemical dynamics was just evolving at that time, and so we were interested. We were not theoreticians ourselves, but I remember even in my exam in Berkeley, by the way, that was another experience as a PhD student that was quite unique. I tell you about that later. But because this came up, understanding chemical reactions from first principles was just beginning to be possible. Even now, still quantum chemistry is complicated. But one of the few reactions that you could more or less do calculations and so on was F plus H2. Okay. And so, because it's very simple and so on, the small molecules and so on, so it somehow or other that came up during my PhD exam, which in Berkeley has the peculiarity that your mentor is not there, so you have to defend it without help of your mentor. But I just bring this up because it just tells you what is the connection between all this, and we saw, hey, that's interesting. These are the molecules we understand, and they are found in the atmosphere. So Sherry proposed, I knew that he was not an atmospheric chemist at all, but he proposed, hey, why don't we learn new fields where we can apply this fundamental chemistry that we're interested in, because as opposed, say, to complex biology, this is a place where small molecules can are important. And so this appears to be a very nice excuse. You find the problem, you try to solve it, and you learn the new field. We had, in one of these small California meetings I was telling you about, we had one presentation about atmospheric chemistry, which was way up in the atmosphere. It had to do with chemistry of ions and so on, which had essentially not connected at all with the sort of things we were interested in. But I guess in the back of our minds was in one of those common conferences that we were, that this was a place where you could apply these things. And we realized, oh, this is, they still have so much to learn that it's sort of primitive. So it certainly attracted my attention. I thought, this is different from the other areas that he's proposing to do. The more, perhaps, I could see perhaps more routine research, you could learn about these reactions. But if you're looking for a place where you might have the opportunity to do something new and different, this looked very attractive. So that's how, essentially how we started. Basically, the only thing we knew from this meeting, and later was published in a very small paper, that these compounds were measurable at very small concentrations, which were reasonable concentrations to expect from the industrial production up to that time of these compounds. With a unique, then we'll of course learning a little bit more about those, with the unique characteristic of these were very stable compounds, so they would probably survive in the atmosphere. But the question is, what happens in, it's a very open question, what process would destroy these molecules in the natural environment? Biology, or some chemical reactions yet to be discovered, or whatever. And so that essentially was the way we started, and from the very beginning being quite different, although of course we interacted with all the other students and so on, but this project was different from all the others, and very open. So I guess Sherry did trust me enough to say, okay, this is something quite different, for we're both beginners. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because normally would you go and do a postdoc with somebody very well known in his field, and you work in his field. Okay. So this was different from that perspective. But and that's how we started. Yeah.
But it was within a relatively short amount of time that you developed the ozone depletion.
Right, because with that question, you might say, well, what can destroy these things? And there might be some catalysis in the Sahara Desert. Gee whiz, but that's probably, if it occurs, it's not very important. I just systematically, then that's something I had to do myself, of course, could interact with Sherry quite a bit, but in some sense, we were both at the same level analyzing these results. And said, well, no, there are none of these things are likely to be important, but what about photolysis, which is something new? Yes, but that has to be way up in the atmosphere. Then we have to learn, okay, how does the atmosphere function, how long it takes to move. Okay, well, I think that's the most likely place where this species, after all, oxygen itself is destroyed at similar altitudes, actually, maybe a little bit higher, but because you get short enough radiation from the sun, so it breaks everything. And they say, okay, well, we might have a reasonable hypothesis to where are these molecules destroyed, and hence, where will they be, and hence we might be, it might be interesting to meteorologists and so on. But hey, I remember this was sort of, as far as I remember very well, something in the back of our minds. We didn't talk it very explicitly at the beginning, but we both had it in our minds. Well, so what? Well, you have these species now in the stratosphere, and just as chemists, we knew some basic chemistry of fossils. Hey, we have chlorine atoms there. Well, they, what will happen? If you want the question for completeness in the back of our minds is, let's look at the whole cycle. So these things are produced industrially, so they're destroyed there. And then eventually the atoms combined, perhaps in different molecular forms, make it back to the Earth's surface. But is there something in between? Yeah, well, they must react with some. Hey, that's, there's, so we knew that the potential for catalytic reactions. What I still remember, this is something then, although we knew, I repeat, we both knew that it was important to also examine the possibility of some consequences. It did sound a little far-fetched at that time. I remember, yeah, but these are small amounts of industrial compounds. But then actually doing the calculation, well, how much is there, and do we know, here again was learning about how the atmosphere functions, do we know what controls the natural levels of ozone? And that's where Paul Crutzen's work was very important, because he's the one, being an engineer of all things and not a chemist, but he learned chemistry very well, and he proposed the natural cycle of ozone in the stratosphere. Of course it was nitrous oxide, but just a very small fraction decomposing to give nitrogen oxide that would then destroy ozone. We were aware from Hal Johnston's work, without being very familiar with it, that there was some concern about SST, supersonic transports, affecting the ozone layer. So in the back of my mind, I said, well, you don't need huge amounts, but let me do the calculation, and then sort of repeating that, hey, that's, I can't believe it, but it is something that might matter. Of course, then discussing it with Sherry, and he immediately realizing, sure, let's look at this, and we'll perhaps even talk to Hal Johnston and so on. And shortly thereafter, he had a sabbatical in Austria, in Vienna. So much of what happened afterwards while we were writing the paper was by correspondence, but we did reach that level of awareness, if you want, which again, it all happened very fast. I do remember saying, well, to do this, I have to do some experiments. So they were very easy experiments, just to take some ultraviolet spectra of this company. Even that was not well known. Ironically, again, this is later, at that time, we're not quite aware, but industry did fund some research on these compounds, but because in the back of their minds were saying, well, let's worry about it, does it matter? And they funded a couple of research groups, and one of them was a spectroscopist, I don't even remember his name, which was interested in vacuum UV spectroscopy. He was looking completely at the wrong range that matters in the atmosphere, but that was all that was known about these molecules. The atmosphere, of course, it was not extremely short wavelengths, which was a specialty of this person. But what we learned later on is that industry was more or less reassured that these compounds are so stable, and even if it wasn't clear how they would destroy, but there's absolutely nothing to worry about. And so that's what led me I'll do a few experiments. So I took some spectra, again, a very easy experiment, but we had to get the samples just to be able to predict more accurately or more carefully how long it would take and where would they, at what wavelengths would they be destroyed and where do you find those wavelengths. And in those months, I also had to learn about atmospheric models and do some calculations then with taking diffusion coefficients and so on to eventually put more numbers to have a more quantitative hypothesis. But the basic hypothesis, as I was telling you, just became clear just by looking at these numbers and comparing them to the natural processes in the atmosphere. So that's why it all happened relatively fast.
And so this came out in Nature in
1990. Yes.
Did you have any difficulty when submitting the article? Did you get criticism from Nature's reviewers?
No, here is what happens. Two things which are sort of, we learn afterwards, it was taken a long time for the review. We thought, is it, what's happening? Is we get some hits? No, it's because that was a very new field and they didn't know who the hell to send this to.
Okay.
So there was Michael Klein, turns out to be one of them, who was a chemist we knew very well, because he was doing experiments and knew a lot about chlorine chemistry, but he was not an atmospheric scientist at all. And they might have sent it to, I don't even know anymore, who were the other reviewers, but they were not many. And at the same time, we had checked with a key, atmospheric scientist in the field, the first one being Hal Johnston, because I had just come out of Berkeley, so it was easy. We went to see him, and it was a very nice meeting and so on, and we offered him, hey, why don't you join us and we publicize this together. He said, no, that's your finding, you will do it, I'll support you or whatever. So he didn't want to be part of it, not because he had any doubts about it, but he thought that was our stuff. But he was in the middle of the stratospheric ozone worries from the SSTs. No? But we also talked to Paul Crutzen. And so the experts in our community, all the sort of immediately bought the idea, if you want. Mm-hmm. And so two things happened. First, one just for fun, Paul presented these results in what he thought was a close meeting in the Swedish Academy of Sciences or so. It turns out there was a reporter there, and so in the Svenska Dagbladet or so, he made news. And we got very worried because Nature has this condition that you cannot have a press release or anything. Fortunately, it didn't make enough news, so nothing happened. But because it was taking many months, okay. But that was our scare story. And the other thing that happened in terms of criticism, it was not from the experts, but once we had to be very quiet about this because of Nature's conditions, except on our friends and so on. But once it got published, then we talked more about it and so on, and eventually at an American Chemical Society meeting. But before that, we did get feedback from other colleagues and chemists, not directly to us, but we heard the rumors that we were just seeking news or to. I mean, it sort of criticism at that time was, if you are in academics, you don't publish in the newspapers, of course. But we didn't. We had a few colleagues that actually did like to publish first in the newspapers, and they were not very highly regarded as scientists. Also in society, they were better known. But that was a criticism, that it looked like something that we were just trying to make noise or to take out. But we fortunately, we didn't take that too seriously. We thought, well, if this, we're putting this as a hypothesis and we're checking that the science is right. And so that's when slowly we decided, hey, this looks serious enough. We have to make an effort to learn to communicate with the media and so on. And so not only not to pay attention to this criticism, but to do it the other way around. If this is real, we should do something about it. Including what did work is to push the academic community connected to this to check it and to begin doing experiments, okay, to check the hypothesis. So that actually worked. But continuing with this, I do remember we decided to take advantage of talking about the ACS, a national ACS meeting, because we knew there were press releases and so on. It was a place where you could communicate to at least to other chemists and so on. So we sort of naively organized a press conference. Okay. And we thought, okay, we made a list. We'll invite first somebody that will tell about the measurements that they are measured in the atmosphere, repeating, sort of summarizing Lovelock's results, and then Paul Crutz and how the atmosphere works, and then we'll tell our story. Why was it very naive? Because that's not the way press conferences work with the media. You have to come up with a punchline at the very beginning. So practically all the reporters left after the very first. So nobody was there when we talked about our findings. Later, of course, we learned hard, and then we did begin to make news, but slowly, because it was not something common. It was a sort of an unusual thing to talk about. Invisible gases, invisible rays, invisible atmosphere. But eventually the media sort of picked it up slowly, but we had to make an effort, and simultaneously we thought, well, let's begin to talk about some politicians, at least in California, so just to see how that would work, because spray cans, of course, was part of the issue and so on. And so essentially that's how we started. And I certainly continued to do research. It was no longer experimental research in the lab, but more modeling and working with the rest of the community. And things, at that time, measurements were carried out with balloons, so working closely with the people in the rest of the community just to promote measurements, are these compounds really getting there, and so on and so forth. So it that's how it took off, if you want.
Yeah, back on the technical stuff, I think I was struck by, you know, this is a new area. There isn't a whole lot of established literature about atmospheric chemistry writ large, especially at this altitude. You're using new equipment. You know, you're talking about Lovelock's electron capture detectors is just kind of being used and experimented with in recent
right.
years. So, you know, on the one side, how do you even go about modeling and doing your own experimental work to try to simulate what's happening up here?
Right.
And was that a concern that you and Roland had about presenting those results into the larger community, that this was, you know, not only did you discover something that could potentially have dramatic effect, there wasn't really an established foundation of literature for people to kind of judge you
right.
on your accuracy.
We thought, and that was indeed a worry, we became sufficiently confident in the science, okay, because you take the larger picture, if you want, and enough was known about the atmosphere say with Paul Crutzen's type science, and there were some measurements, balloons were already sent. Much of the measurements, much of what was known, was really dominated by physics or meteorology, was dynamics, as they call it. Of course, we chemists, when we talk about dynamics, it's chemical dynamics, but in that community, that's atmospheric dynamics. And there was already a well-developed interest in learning about atmospheric movements in the stratosphere. So much of what was known about stratospheric ozone was just with the objective of seeing how the stratosphere is quite different from the troposphere, how do things move in the stratosphere. So it was sort of a nuisance that ozone was chemically active and not just a good tracer, okay? So we knew about the movements, and we knew about, at least in relatively simple terms, how do species get to the stratosphere and what are the main species that are there, okay? So it was enough known, again, with this carrying out the simple calculations, that this looked like, of course, we're not sure, we knew this was a hypothesis, but it was sound, okay? Then that's why we decided, okay, it's not something just entirely far-fetched. Maybe this will be we were able to document this with the science that, because it was not terribly complicated. You know. Of course, much we realized that additional experiments had to be carried out measuring the CFCs ever. We were practically sure if these compounds are stable, even if some of that gets destroyed, lower altitudes, they certainly have to get there. One of the questions was, is there a process that will destroy them in competition to destruction in the stratosphere, which means that only a smaller fraction will get there, but the numbers appear to indicate that it was because the numbers of what was in the atmosphere were comparable to what had been industrially produced, so we knew there was no fast process. So there were a few key ideas like that, and then we realized, okay, where we need to carry out research as a community is, are chlorine compounds actually measurable there? And we knew effects on also, well, this, we knew it would take some time, at least a decade or so, before anything could be measured because of the large natural variability. But yeah, what you mentioned was a concern, but we were sufficiently convinced, if you want, that we thought this is worth pushing without exaggeration. So we always expressed experiments need to be carried out. This is a hypothesis, but it is something. Our push was, let's do the research. Let's not just ignore it. Say it's a real, with the science that we have and with the support of the experts in the community, that's what reassured us, if you want, that this was not crazy, this made a lot of sense. Yeah. Let's invest, and we're not talking about huge resources, let's use some of the balloons that are already being used to learn about movements, let's do some chemistry with those. And so that's how things got moved. Then later, that perhaps is more for tomorrow, if you want, but some of the important subsequent steps, very much connected with this question, though, was, okay, let's see whether we, how can we sort of reassure the scientific community? Well, National Academy studies, okay. Mm-hmm. So that's how they got started, and of course, this was sufficiently sound so that the National Academy, we had many friends there, of course, we were reasonably well respected in the academic environment, in spite of this criticism, there were always people criticized, and so that a study by the National Academy did make sense. And in those years, or the more that's tomorrow's topic, we had to do more science. The chemistry is not quite as simple as we initially postulated. There might be other complications. So I continue to. One peculiar thing, if you want, but that's, I was a postdoc for relatively short term, because mm-hmm. once we published this and so on, and Sherry very, very nicely and so on, they said, well, you let's keep doing this, but you will do it, you should be a faculty already. And the one complication is, when you're a faculty, in the US in particular, the first years are hard to get tenure, you have to show you can do research independently. So in some sense, I had to stop collaborating with Sherry. Mm-hmm. But we had already the background established. So the experimental work that we did was then independent for this reason. So I kept doing laboratory work in, but it was already much more defined, connected with what we thought might be the chemistry in the stratosphere.
So you said that the two of you set out on this project to combine at the same time what you liked about this project versus some of the other things that Sherry was working on when you came to postdoc. This was something that there was a real question to be explored,
right,
and resolved. And there was some fundamental chemistry to be learned about, the physical chemistry, the kinetics behind
right.
how some of these things were happening. You've published the paper in Nature. Did you feel like you were still maintaining that balance, or did you feel like you might be getting pulled in one direction over the other at this point?
No, we thought we had made the right choice, and in some sense that was indeed correct, because it turns out that the stratosphere is chemically relatively simple, and most of the important chemistry occurs with relatively small species, and so we're not that far. That's why I brought this F plus H2, okay? These were reactions that you could attempt to understand at the very fundamental level. And again, I'm jumping way ahead, but yes, in fact, much was learned in chemical kinetics, which is what I told you I was interested in even when I went to Germany. But this was now with not all that different, although we were talking about big molecules before, not all that different, but much was learned about the fundamental science, doing research that was at the same time quite practical. Here we have something that is happening in real life, and we have a chemical reactor, which is the planet. We can, of course, try to select some of that here, but we can go and check it. Okay. And just to give you one example, I might be jumping way ahead, but we know chemical kinetics, chemical reactions, you have an activation energy, and normally reactions go faster as you increase the temperature. That's why you can cook. That's all, because everything breaks down. Hey, but there were some experimental results we had, and this is my good friend Ravi and so on, that there were some reactions that work in the other way around. So the first reaction of the community was, oh, these are experimental errors, these are complicated things to study. No, and then it was realized, but this is just one example, very clear. No, there are complex reactions where you have an intermediate and you have channels, and some of them we now understand very well why they go faster at lower temperatures. That was strictly a result of stratospheric chemistry, if you want. So it's one example of something along the lines you were asking. Yes, fundamental research moved on. The other, of course, very important component, jumping ahead, is chemistry of free radicals. In the laboratory, it was just beginning to be possible to study reactions with free radicals directly. Before it was all done in bulk vessels indirectly, but at that time we and others developed means of measuring directly the free radical, and then you can do much, much more reliable chemistry, not just inferring, the free radicals were there and they probably did. These there were important historical examples of reaction mechanisms that were indeed inferred that way. But this was another very interesting opportunity to push the science, and yes, it was very exciting to combine fundamental lab science with something that's happening that you could actually check. Yeah. So that did work.
Well, that seems like a good stopping place.
Okay.
Until tomorrow, if that's all right for you.
Sure, by all means, yes.
Thank you.